Gee, there's a hush over the room. I guess it's time to start. My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you on behalf of our board, on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins, to this program to examine the ways that the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act encourages innovation and improvement in the ways we pay for health care in America. Now, there are two aspects of the recent reform debate that come to mind in that context. One is the mantra about the need to bend the cost curve, I hasten to add, downward, over time. And one of our panelists, as a matter of fact, Stu Gutterman of the Commonwealth Fund, he may not have coined the phrase, but he certainly popularized it as much as anybody. The other is the less frequently repeated mantra that the U.S. has the best health care system in the world. Beth McGlynn and her colleagues at the Rand Corporation, however, found that Americans get the best care and the right care just slightly more than half the time. So Congress and the President responded in the reform law by loading a number of arrows into the cost and quality quiver, if you will, to be sharpened and put into use over time over these next few years. And today's program is a closer look at some of those tools and at the likelihood that they can achieve the, I think, very ambitious goals that were set out in the new law. We're pleased to have as our partner in today's program, the Commonwealth Fund, a philanthropy based in New York City that's been extremely active over the last several years in trying to explain various payment system options to policymakers. And as I've noted before, ideas like medical homes and bending the cost curve were almost cliches at Commonwealth before anybody else knew what they meant. I guess the only thing else I would say is that, to repeat a cliche, if they tell you it's not about the money, it's about the money. And we're going to hear today about how the money flows, how it ought to flow, what kind of changes are in place to help shape that flow, how long they're going to take, and what we do in the interim. A challenging set of questions, but we fortunately have a great panel to address them. A couple of quick logistical items. You have materials, including biographical information in your packets about this topic and about our panel. We also have a number of pieces of background information online and a list of those that are in your packets as well. If you are watching on C-SPAN and have access to a computer, you can go to allhealth.org and you'll find all of the background information, including the slides that the folks in the audience here are going to see, on that site. So I think that's all we have. We have a webcast and a podcast of this briefing that will be available tomorrow, thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation. In a few days, you can also view a transcript of the briefing and relive every fabulous rhetorical moment at allhealth.org. For those of you in the room, I remind you that you have a question card that you can use once we get to the discussion part of the program and a blue evaluation form that we profoundly hope that you will fill out and help us improve these programs as we go along. So let's get to the program. We have an incredibly good group of panelists today with a broad range of experience, and we're going to start with the aforementioned Stuart Gutterman. Stu is the Assistant Vice President for Commonwealth's Program on Payment System Reform. Many of the background publications in your materials, both in the packets and on the website, bear Stu's name. He's done turns as a senior official at CBO and at MedPAC. He ran CMS's Office of Research, Development, and Information, where he was actually responsible for several important demonstration projects involving payments. So we're very happy to have him start us off. Stu?
Thanks, Ed. I'm going to start by modifying something Ed just said, which is that if it indeed is about the money, it's about how the money can be used to improve healthcare delivery, because that's really the focus that that innovation needs to have. It's generally agreed that we have a payment system that provides all the wrong incentives, and it's generally agreed that the result is rapidly rising healthcare costs and quality that's disappointing, particularly when you think about how much we spend. I have to thank Al Dobson and Don Moran for an article that I was reading years ago that had this part of this quote in it. This is a quote from Franklin Roosevelt when he was campaigning for his first term as president, and it kind of captures the attitude that I think needs to be adopted going into the period of health reform. And the bottom line here is, but above all, try something. And I think we need to really keep that in mind as we're thinking about innovations in payment and healthcare delivery. It also contains an acknowledgement that we may fail occasionally, and I think that's something that needs to be borne in mind, too, because we need to keep moving toward improved healthcare delivery, even if everything we do with that intent doesn't necessarily succeed the way we'd like. So what are the problems that we're facing? Well, we have fragmented care. We have a lack of coordination in healthcare delivery. We have variable quality across parts of the country, across facilities, and we have high and rapidly growing costs. That's not a recipe that sounds very tasty to us, especially in this era of health reform. So our goals are to create the right incentives to increase accountability for patient care outcomes and resource use, to provide rewards for improved care coordination, as well as quality and efficiency, to slow growth and to put in place an infrastructure that supports providers in improving quality and efficiency. And the question, of course, is how do we do that? And that's what we have to try different approaches toward. This is a graphic that kind of lays out the three dimensions of healthcare financing and delivery reform. On the left-hand vertical axis, you see a continuum of payment bundling that ranges from the current fee-for-service system to all the way up to global payment, which provides a single payment for a bundle of care that covers an entire time period for the enrollee. On the horizontal axis, you see the continuum of organizations. We have in our healthcare system now a variety of types of healthcare organization, ranging from small and individual practices, independent hospitals, all the way up to fully integrated delivery systems, which we do have a number of. And then on the right-hand axis, we have a continuum of rewards for high performance or pay for performance. And we have simple ways, process-oriented ways of paying for performance, and we have the capacity to develop more sophisticated ways that include system measures and rewards for high performance. And the important thing to understand about these rewards is not that they reward good doctors and penalize bad doctors, although they certainly might. It's that they provide the right signals. Right now, our system rewards performance. It rewards more volume. It rewards more invasive procedures. It involves more care, but not rewards more care, but not necessarily better care. And so, sending signals that the payment system, that the healthcare system wants better care and more appropriate care and more coordinated care is extremely important. But being able to provide the right incentives depends on the organizational environment that you're starting with, and we need to understand as we're developing initiatives to improve care that we're starting from different points in different places, and in fact, even the set of organizations that are at the extreme right-hand side of this graph in the fully integrated delivery system category are very different from each other because they evolved in different environments, and so we need to be sensitive to that as we're developing the right policies to deal with them. In the health reform legislation, there are a number of new payment models that are either expanded or initiated, and they include the medical home, which is the provisions in the law expand the current Medicare demonstration that's in development, provide new Medicare pilots. The Medicare home, the medical home, is a construct where you have primary care at the center of health care, and where the primary care provider is the source, the connection of the patient to the rest of the healthcare system. It's kind of the way I view it. It's kind of like having a general contractor for your healthcare rather than having to make all of the decisions about where to go and who to go to yourself. The ACO is a very popular model these days, the Accountable Care Organization. It is basically a group of providers who are willing to accept broad responsibility for quality and cost of patient care. It usually has rewards for quality and shared savings in it. The provision in the law certainly has a shared savings model for financing it. It's very popular partly because it's such a flexible model, because people who look at it see whatever they want to see. But that's probably not a bad thing, because it needs to be a flexible model, because, as I said, it gets implemented in different places in different ways. The main thing is that we need to understand that the healthcare system has a right to expect from the providers and from the other components of the system one thing consistently across the board, and that is good quality and reasonable costs. And how you achieve that has to be designed with the particular environment in mind. There are bundled payments, which include single payments to cover groups of services, including hospital and post-acute care together. There are several Medicaid initiatives for global payments. The Medicare Advantage program undergoes a lot of changes, and there's been a lot of focus on changes in the way Medicare Advantage is paid for. But a key point is that Medicare Advantage should be looked at as a vehicle for providing models of coordinated care and making them available to Medicare patients, and providing a model for how the rest of the healthcare system ought to work. And there's a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, and I think that may be the most important provision from the perspective of making health reform sustainable over the long run. I've got a number of details on the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. It begins in 2011, and basically the Secretary of Health and Human Services has broad authority to expand or extend models that are being examined and tried based on their promise for providing higher quality and lower cost. There are some key considerations in terms of how the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation ought to operate that need to be taken into account. One is multi-payer involvement. We currently have not only a fragmented healthcare delivery system, but also a fragmented healthcare financing system. And as long as we have the fragmented financing, it's very difficult to make good progress towards coordinated care delivery. So more coordination among different payers to at least make their policies consistent with each other, I think, is called for in this process. Being willing to entertain ground-up as well as top-down development of new initiatives, that is, there are many initiatives that are out there in the field, and Medicare and Medicaid ought to be willing and able to participate in some of those initiatives, as well as developing their own. There needs to be, as I said before, an array of potential models, because this doesn't play out the same way everywhere across the country. There needs to be flexibility in design and implementation. I refer to the change in attitude that needs to take place as try versus test. That is, when you say you want to test new innovations, that kind of implies that you're waiting back on your heels for something to be proven to you, as opposed to being willing to try new things and keeping them going as long as they seem to be working. I think we need to have that change in attitude to kind of free us up to try, be willing to try new things. We need to establish an infrastructure to support success. That is, we're not testing folks to see if they can do this on their own. We're trying to see how we can have a better healthcare delivery system that delivers better care at lower cost to our people. And the federal government can do a lot of things and have started to do a lot of things to help that make that more possible, including improving health information technology. The federal government's put a lot of money into that in the stimulus package and, again, in the health reform legislation. And I think there are other kind of shared resources that can be put into effect, like community-level coverage that provides 24-hour, 7-day-a-week access to health care, practice nurses or other practitioners that can help work with chronic care patients to improve how they manage their care. And again, we'd like to see these new initiatives be plugged into what MedPAC does and what the new Medicare Commission does, and also to feed into the Medicaid Division Commission does, and also feed into the Independent Payment Advisory Board deliberations so that they have more tools at their disposal for trying to bring health costs under control. And I think to improve the process, we also need better transparency. And when I say transparency, I mean a two-sided situation where you have the goals and objectives of innovations be crystal clear so that people know what they're getting into and people know what to expect. And also you have information available that enables you to monitor these innovations continuously to make sure that we know what's working and what isn't working and how to modify things on the fly to help them work better. And of course, resource availability is crucial. We need to make sure that sufficient resources are available to develop, implement, monitor, evaluate these innovations and to turn them into workable policies. And I'll end with another inspirational statement, this one recently by Atul Gawande, who talked about the role of government in kind of spurring new innovation. He was particularly referring to healthcare, and he used the Agricultural Extension Service as an example of how that's worked successfully. And the key in this quote is the last four words, we've done it before. This is a big challenge, but I think we need to be up to it because the alternative just isn't very pleasant. And I want to also thank Heather Drake, who's my co-author on the paper that was in your packets, and you can get more information from the Commonwealth Fund website. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Stu. By the way, I think this is the first time we've had the convention center size screen available, and I hope that it helps you in the back see some of the more impenetrable slides that we sometimes put up. Next, we're going to hear from a variety of perspectives and expertises about the way payment can and can't work. And first in that lineup, we're pleased to welcome back Gail Walensky, senior fellow at Project HOPE, health economist extraordinaire. Gail ran the agency that's now known as CMS. She was chair of MedPAC for several years. She was the main health and welfare advisor to President George H.W. Bush. And I'm pleased to say she is not frequent enough panelist at the Alliance briefings. Gail, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to make four or five points that support and expand on some of the comments that Stuart Gutterman just made. The first is to indicate that this is the right strategy to be taking now. There is widespread agreement across different parts of the political spectrum that disaggregated fee-for-service, particularly as we know it in physician payment, where physicians are billing Medicare some 7,000 or 8,000 different codes, is an anathema relative to the way we want to see healthcare move, where we reward providers, institutional and clinical, who produce good quality care with appropriate clinical outcomes in an efficient way. The problem is while we have an idea about what a better system would look like, we have very little knowledge about how to get there from where we are. Where we are is a completely different world where most physicians are practicing in single specialty practices, usually of three or four individuals, 75% of the physicians practicing of groups that are fewer than nine, mostly not affiliated or aligned in any type of formal way with the hospitals where they practice. So the problem is, given that we are in such a different space, how do we try to use the payment system to begin to transform the organization and delivery of healthcare? Recognizing that it will be difficult and that one model is not going to work everywhere in this country. Second point is to be mindful of our history. One of the advantages of being older than most around this table, other than Ed, he keeps me company in that vein, is that having seen some of these attempts before, a word of caution and warning. Yes, this is different from some of our previous attempts to use demonstrations to change the way healthcare is delivered or paid for in the Medicare program. It does give more authority to the secretary. It does provide for additional funding for the agency. It sets up a new center for innovations. Nonetheless, we have a lot of history to suggest that putting out changed payment mechanisms is cumbersome, takes time, needs to be developed and accepted by the Congress and by the participants in the process, and will take some time to both play out and to assess in order to upscale to see whether it can work on a broader level, and that all of these stages are fraught with difficulties where it is easy to have it become unglued or derailed. The third point is that it is extremely important to have realistic expectations, and I'd like to at least share a word of caution that I've been feeling when I have been reading some of the comments of my colleagues, which seem to express an optimism and enthusiasm that bears no relationship to the reality that I know. And that is the notion that these payment innovations, which are discussed and included in the pilots, will be producing major savings, way underestimated by the Congressional Budget Office, within the next budget period. Yes, we have all said many times that we believe that there are ways that healthcare in the U.S. could be organized and delivered, which would allow us to do so at substantially slower rates of growth and spending, or even potentially at absolutely less. But we know that the history of trying to make these changes is fraught with difficulty. If we are aggressive in starting, if we are imaginative in what we try to see played out across the country, and if we are lucky that we pick some good models and that they can be scalable, it is possible to imagine in the second 5 years of this coming decade, perhaps, or more likely in the decade that follows, significant changes to how healthcare is organized and delivered, and therefore a very different trajectory in terms of healthcare spending. But the notion that we are likely to see anything in a significant way different in this next 3 to 4 year period, or more likely in the second 5 years of this coming decade, just bears, as far as I'm concerned, no relationship to reality. It might be just dismissed as being over-enthusiasm by a group that is very pleased with having seen healthcare reform passed and now law of the land. I'm more worried that when you have unrealistic expectations and they're not achieved, that it then spawns undesirable behavior in its aftermath. We're going to hear later from Nick Walter about an example of the group practice physician demonstration, which I am a big supporter of. But in some ways, we can look at that history and see why we need to put all of this change in some kind of perspective. This was an example that first was thought about in the early part of the decade. It took until about 2003 or 2004 until the RFP was actually released. We had 10 of the most promising sites in the country that agreed to participate, places where we might have expected to see sure winners. It took, in fact, in its first year, only two that were able to achieve both hurdles, that is, both the quality and the efficiency hurdle. And we are now ending that decade, and we are still trying to understand and see what we can make from this very promising demonstration. I don't think that it always needs to take that long, but it's a good reminder when even good ideas can take a long time to play themselves out. Fourth, I have some concerns that we need to assure ourselves that there's enough variation in these pilots in terms of who gets the money that we will really understand the implications of having money primarily going to the hospitals or to groups of physicians or to payers or to various mixes. My concern, although depending on who you speak to, you can hear the opposite concern raised, is that because hospitals tend to be more organized with more significant infrastructures, that they are more likely to lay claim to the dollars for accountable care organizations than, say, groups of physicians. And that while I think it's important to understand what happens to accountable care organizations that are led by hospitals and where the hospitals are the primary recipients of the money, I am uneasy of that as either the only model or maybe even the dominant model, seeing what has happened during the current decade where we've had substantial consolidation of hospitals and hospital power, and therefore the not surprising result of seeing the influence of this hospital consolidation in terms of increased pricing and spending, particularly in the private sector. I don't want to not see the models where the hospitals are the recipients of the funding, but I think we need to be sure that it is not the only model there. A final thought is that the specifics can be really important. There is, as I've indicated, in my mind at least, widespread agreement about the nature of the variety of demonstrations that we in pilots that we want to see, the accountable care organizations and medical homes, et cetera. But the specifics can be very important in how they play out. And I just want to give a couple of short examples about why these specifics might matter so much. We were speaking earlier this morning about the importance of trying to encourage in the Medicare Advantage program real coordination and making use of the coordinated possibilities that Medicare Advantage might offer to seniors. There is now, as you know, a bonus program that is available for those who are able to show that they are providing higher quality care. But the specifics will be very important. Should it be only for the top 10 or 15%? Should it be graded on a curve? Or should it be available to those who perform at good quality, particularly relative to the fragmented fee-for-service? Are the measures that are being used, which weren't really developed for payment purposes, the right measures? And if not, how quickly can we change them so that they become so? And finally, since we give so much attention to the potential role of accountable care organizations as a different model to use going forward, we need to remind ourselves that it's not just the providers that need to learn how to play differently. We need to be sure that we're involving the seniors as well. I at least have not heard nearly so much attention focused on what it will take to get seniors involved in being a part of accountable care organizations as opposed to what it will take to get physicians and hospitals interested in seeing whether they can share savings that are produced in this different organizational structure. So the right general strategy, keep the expectations reasonable and realistic, and don't forget about the details.
Terrific. Thank you, Gail. Mark Miller's up next. Most of you know Mark is the executive director of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. It sounds pretty relevant to today's topic to me. So his official job is advising those of you on congressional staffs about matters involving Medicare payment and quality and access. He's also occupied senior positions at both CBO and OMB, as well as within CMS itself. And those of you who are around the country and don't know what all those things mean, go to our website and it explains all of the acronyms. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Sure. And there'll be some overlap in the comments that you've heard so far. So with my inflection of my voice or with gestures, I'll try and make it sound different. So the first thing I would say is that the commission has there was a framing of the problems at the beginning of this, and for several years now the commission has maintained that fee-for-service incentives are fee-for-service is part of the problem, that it is not designed to coordinate care, it does not focus on quality, volume is what it rewards, and for many years we've been pushing for different strategies for reimbursing providers in Medicare that would promote focus on quality and try to be more judicious in the use of resources. And many of the ideas that are being contemplated now, medical homes, the bundling strategies, ACOs, more focus on primary care, are all things that for several years now we've been writing to. And so like Gail, I think the commission agrees that this is the right direction at the right time. More specifically to the notion of pilots, demonstrations, the innovation center, that notion which has been put on the table. You know, there again, the commission has spoke about the need for more resources specifically devoted to this, the idea of flexibilities in order to cycle through ideas and try things more rapidly, and the flexibility for the secretary to implement things that she finds are effective. And so there again, the commission is, you know, in the same place where we seem to be headed with this. Now, there are some other comments that I would make, and, you know, just before I leave that one, I think that as we go through this, I think we'll even see that there are other flexibilities that the agency may need in order to execute this as they go. I think that the agency will encounter problems with their current procedures, and we may even need to think about other processes that need to be relaxed a bit in order to move this at the speed that some people hope or people are already anticipating. But then just to shift a bit and talk about money, since, you know, that is at least one focus here. One positive development that I've seen over the many years that I've been doing this is a much more linkage between the Congress asking CMS to undertake some new responsibility and actually giving CMS resources to do this. This happens more frequently. We can argue over the size and how closely connected it is, but more and more that's happening, and I think it's a positive thing. And at least in this legislation, there's money to implement the overall legislation and money set aside for the Innovation Center, which a lot of my comments are going to be on. I think we have to be vigilant, and I think that both as Congress and the executive branch, that the money actually is protected and used for those purposes. Sometimes when blocks of money are put out there, I know this comes as a surprise, people begin to try and redirect or define themselves as part of that task. And I think it will be very important that we stay focused, and if this is what we want to use this money for, to try things, then we should be vigilant about that. I think the trade-off, and again, I think Stuart mentioned this point, so again, this is one of those two-time things, but I think the trade-off for CMS is transparency. So if they're going to be given these resources and they're going to be given this extra authority to go out and implement the program, that's a big deal to providers, to beneficiaries, to the Congress. And I think it will be very important that CMS spend a lot of effort in keeping people informed. If a demonstration or pilot is going south, telling people and coming forward and keeping people informed regularly. The most important thing, I think, is no surprises. Some of this stuff is going to work. Some of it isn't going to work. I think the key will be to keep Congress informed so it doesn't come as a shock when something, they either take an action to implement something further or they take an action to stop. And by the way, this is stuff I know the CMS folks know, and I've talked to them, and so these aren't things that they haven't thought of themselves, just so that the tone doesn't come across that way. With respect to research and sort of actually doing the pilots and thinking about the innovation centers, a couple things occur to me. You know, there is this notion of trying to set up networks of providers to generate ideas and then to take those ideas into more of a formal pilot and put it out on a broader scale. And I think that could be potentially one way to keep ideas moving and to move through things quickly. But it's definitely something that I don't think CMS has a lot of experience with, and I think will be something that will have to be worked through. I think it's very important that quality is improved. I want to be absolutely clear about this before I say the next thing I'm going to say. It's very important that quality is improved, and I think even some of the demonstrations that are along these lines has shown that there are ways to improve quality. What I think is murkier and absolutely has to come out of these tests is to figure out whether we can reduce the expenditure trend. And I think it's absolutely critical that that happen. In some ways, I think the Commission, beyond improving quality and coordinating care, is looking at some of these ideas as the next generation to affect the trend in spending. And so these pilots, I think, are absolutely critical in that sense. Regardless of the timing, whether it's sooner or later, and I agree with Gail that we may not see things right off, but that should decidedly be an objective. I also think that there's a kind of a difficulty that we're all going to have to face here, which is this. In order to move faster and innovate as you go, it will be much harder to definitively put a pin in something and say this worked and here's how much it worked. It was 10, not 9, those types of statements. And, of course, that's the way to move quickly, get things done, test ideas. But for people who have to do scoring, CBO, Office of the Actuary, and say, does this idea actually work, it's going to be in some ways harder potentially to pin that down. I believe there are ways that are probably can work through to accommodate that, but it's decidedly something that we'll have to be aware of. Another thing I'll say is that I think we should be conscious of how models can work. There are ways where, take bundling, for example, one of the key issues that everybody gets pretty wrapped around an axle on is who gets the money, who gets my check. And, you know, to be conscious here, these ideas are about redistributing money and changing the incentives in the current system. We cannot agree that the current system doesn't work and that flows of money don't work and then not change that. And so I think people get fairly focused on that. One way to think about these another way to think about these models is to do it more in a virtual sense, where you say, I'm going to let fee-for-service continue to flow, but look at the bundle and reward or penalize on the basis of the bundle. So it's not that you have to say, I'm giving the dollars for that bundle to one person as much as I'm going to make payments plus or minus on the basis of the bundle. Can't tell if that was clear, but got to keep moving. So, sorry about that. We have this clock ticking out. It's like an episode of 24, you know. Okay, so anyway, I would just urge people to think about models that way. And I am going to make time here, so don't panic anybody. The other thing I would say is two of the biggest complaints that I've heard from participants in demonstrations and pilots are these things, and hopefully they can be addressed. Number one is data to the participants in a timely way. The notion that if you're involved in a demonstration, you know where you stand or you have the claims data in order to see what the population is doing. And hopefully, with the money that's going to the Innovation Center, there will be some ability to devote effort to that or resources to that. And the second thing is knowing the targets in advance. This raises methodological issues, performance issues, that type of thing. But the notion that the provider, when they enter this, they know what the target is, not knowing that they missed the target, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago. And I think that will be critical. Another thing that I think we should keep in mind is that consolidation of providers seems to be good for coordination of care and achieving episode focus on quality of care. But consolidation can also, depending on what the incentives are, generate volume. And consolidation on the private sector side can inflate prices if they're a monopoly in a market. And so we need to be very conscious that as we drive these systems, there are externalities that can occur as a result of that. Last two comments, and I think Gail made these as well, so I'll just be reinforcing here, but say try and use some gestures to make it sound different. She's absolutely correct that we are very focused on fee-for-service here, and I think we should be, and these systems are for fee-for-service. But remember, we do have a managed care program, and you know, a well-run managed care program can actually be a good platform for coordinating care and reducing resources. I want to emphasize that not all managed care programs have that focus and that capability, but many do, and it's a good platform to think about. And the other little piece of it is that CMS, I believe, is going to be collecting encounter data from the managed care plans, and that may help inform some of the tactics that are used in managed care plans and may inform the fee-for-service side. And the last thing I would say is I could not agree more with Gail's point that there's also another actor here, the beneficiary, and we have to be conscious of the incentives for them to participate in these types of projects and changes in delivery system. But also, in and of themselves, we're trying to work on signals to the provider community, but being aware of beneficiary signals as one of the actors involved in the consumption of care. And I'll stop.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Our final speaker, if I can turn my microphone on, our final speaker is Dr. Nicholas Wolter, who's the CEO of the Billings Clinic in Billings, Montana. Now, we have some high-powered policy analysis gurus on this panel, and as it turns out, Dr. Wolter is one of them. He's served a couple of terms on MedPAC himself, but he's also in the trenches. His clinic is one of the exemplary, fully integrated health systems in the country. I suspect he found himself answering questions from a bunch of you during the health reform debate about how his system functioned and how he made it work so well. And we're very pleased to have him to share some of that information as well as the broader picture with us today. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Wolter.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here to speak to you today. I had hoped to combine this trip with attending a Capitals playoff game, but maybe next year. What I'd like to do is take you very quickly on a tour through the accountable or the group practice demo, because I think there are some lessons there that might apply to the world that we're headed into. And accountable care organization terminology in many ways did come out of some conversations at MedPAC, some work by the Dartmouth group, Elliot Fisher. In fact, there are two courses or meetings a week now on how to form accountable care organizations. It's become quite the mania, much as integrated healthcare delivery systems did in the 90s. The Billings Clinic is fairly large. We're about 240 physicians, other providers, and we're quite integrated in that this organization includes a hospital. We also manage and work with six critical access hospitals, so we're very involved in rural health. I mention that because although in many ways we feel ready for what we're headed into, there are lots of things that we have yet to learn. The group practice demo included these organizations, and I think one of the interesting things is it included multi-specialty groups with no formal hospital relationship, included a group of organizations that did include a group practice and hospitals, and it included some academic centers. And so there is a variety of organizational types, as Stu mentioned in his talk, that were part of this demo. In Montana, we have some challenges based on our geography. We serve for tertiary care almost 500,000 people, but they could be 200 miles away from us. Some of these people were actually assigned to us as our responsibility in this demo. And just to quickly point out that from southeast Montana to northwest is the distance from Washington, D.C. to Chicago. The demo really was based on could we reduce rate of growth of Medicare spending, annual spending per beneficiary per year. It was designed, as most things were in recent years, to be budget neutral and to involve both financial targets as well as quality targets. And this slide just illustrates that as the years in the demo unfolded, more of the performance pay, so to speak, migrated to quality, and it became 50-50 based on quality and financial performance. But there was a threshold. If you did not reach the threshold for financial performance, you did not share in any savings. We had very robust quality measures in the areas of diabetes, heart failure, coronary artery disease, hypertension, and certain cancer screenings. This, without going through it, shows, I think, what would be considered a very good group of measures that, to some degree, would reflect, are we doing a good job managing people's health? And I would say this, too, in the bottom right-hand of this slide, the financial savings were largely inpatient-driven because that's where more cost and spending is, although the quality measures in this case were largely outpatient-driven. And you can imagine the interesting situation for those groups that were group practice but no hospital was involved because they were taking measures to reduce hospital spending, even though that did not involve their own organization. In our case, whenever we reduced hospital spending, we reduced our own revenue. Just one slice of something we did, we enrolled fairly sick people with heart failure. We used a telephony system to track certain of their signs and symptoms daily, and when certain triggers were hit, they were actively managed by a nurse. And what we found is that we had a significant performance in terms of averting admissions. And these two graphs, one is our measures, the other was the research group RTI that sort of validated things. But we averted enough admissions over this period of time that it probably saved the program $3 to $4 million. If you could generalize that across the country in terms of management of congestive heart failure, there would be significant savings. As Gail mentioned, if you look at this demo honestly, and it did probably lead to savings, I can't quite read that, but I think I remember $232 million on the far right. As a numerator over all of the Medicare spending in all of these groups, that would not be a large percentage. And so I think we have to try to learn what we can from what went on well in this demo, but also to understand we have a lot of work to do to try to raise the bar. This just shows how the years unfolded. Initially a 3-year demo became a 5-year demo. Now we are looking at can we migrate this into an accountable care organization pilot. Accountability was local, that is, we were responsible, and yet we had to organize a lot of things that we did not necessarily have complete control over. Stu has covered some of this, but as we look at shared savings, comparing it to fee-for-service and capitation, different incentives unfold. And the idea of trying to reduce expenditures as you move toward capitation, obviously the financial incentive to do that is quite a bit higher. And I show this slide because under the provider list there, when you are organizing to provide coordinated care for the patients you're assigned, you have a lot of services that have to be organized. In some cases, they're not in your organization. We're part of the PACE program for the frail elderly, and we're having to contract with providers for services that we don't provide. That's a very good learning for us right now in terms of how we might look at these accountable care organization pilots. Again, some of the new financial incentives that will be coming our way that have already been discussed, and I think we're going to see experiments in all of these areas. I like the slide that Stu and the Commonwealth Fund show. The thing I would, in terms of the relationship between payment and organizational type, the thing I would like to emphasize is the word feasibility here, because we do have a number of best practicing organizations in the United States right now that receive fee-for-service, and yet they're coordinating care and providing care in the lowest quartile of cost, and those are organizations like Intermountain Healthcare, Mayo Clinic, Billings Clinic, Geisinger, and so we have models out there that are doing good work. Again, we're going to see a trend toward looking at more organization of the payment system, hopefully to incent more organizations of this type. And then this is some of the language from the health reform bill that talks about accountable care organizations and how different models might be tried. I don't want to read through this line by line. I think it's in your packet. But I think we're going to try to learn from the demo, that the group practice demo, in terms of how we look at accountable care organization requirements and how the financial model works. I did want to discuss a few design issues. Attribution, by that I mean how are patients assigned to us that we are then responsible for? And in the case of the group practice demo, if they received a plurality of their outpatient care, in other words, maybe less than 50% of their outpatient visits were us, they were assigned to us. I think that the beneficiary participation question that's been raised by both Gail and Mark is important. Beneficiaries didn't know they were in a demo. And actually, we didn't know who they were. They didn't tell us who they were until later. We were given performance results, but in terms of knowing which patients we were managing, we did not know them by name. It's very difficult to do managed care when you don't have a good sense of who is your population. The issue of rapid performance feedback, it was as long as 2 years sometimes before we received data back on how we were doing in this demonstration project. Risk adjustment, very important, but not an exact science. Some of the organizations who did receive shared savings did so because their risk scores were significantly higher than other organizations. This comes down to coding and how well you know how to risk or how you know how to demonstrate severity. That's another factor that needs attention. Infrastructure investment, it cost us $125 per beneficiary per month for those patients in our heart failure program. And we did know who they were in that particular case because we actually enrolled them. That was about $100,000 a year, but we spent significantly more than that in total to manage this. The financial design, unless you received a 2% improvement in savings, you received no shared savings. I think there are some issues with that, and once you go beyond that, perhaps sharing in all the savings would make sense. And then some of us really wonder, will shared savings be a good long-term design feature? We're not sure. It's very complicated to devise shared savings models, and so hopefully there'll be some other things tested in the pilots. I would like to respond, too, to Mark, based on our experience. I'm not much of a fan of virtual bundling because I think it's hard to manage care unless you know who you're taking care of, but presumably both of these models may be tested. And then just quickly, a few other thoughts. I think it's important to continue to focus on high-volume, high-cost areas of care. If we want to bend the cost curve, we should start where the low-hanging fruit is. We need to refine fee-for-service payment at the same time that we're doing these other new payment models because fee-for-service is out of whack in a number of ways. We make a ton of money in my organization on heart disease, neurosurgery, orthopedics, but we lose our shirt in mental health. We need to rebalance that, and the same would be true in terms of how physicians are paid. Other incentives that drive fragmented behavior include physician ownership, other relationships that physicians have with pharmacy and device manufacturers. And, of course, hospitals have their own behaviors, too, because they like to work with physicians to drive volume. The relationship between delivery system and organization and payment policy can be nonlinear, as I mentioned. There are organizations motivated to do the right thing, which leads me to emphasize leadership and culture will be a big part of the next 5 to 10 years. As we see how the delivery system changes. We really need that in addition to payment reform. Collaborative learning, when you get into these pilots, if you can share with the others that are in them, you really can learn from best practices. And then I often hear that some of these things can't work in rural health care. I won't go into it in detail now. Rural health care is ready for some of this, and I hope we'll have a chance. This is a 17-year-old quote. Jeff Goldsmith, a healthcare futurist. The key to new integrated health models is collegiality. It's not just payment. It's not bricks and mortar. I'll pass on that slide. And just to finish, this is a quote from 1913, Dr. Charlie Mayo. The past 50 years have been marked by advances in the science of medicine. The next 50 will be marked by improvements in the organization and teamwork of how health care is delivered. I think he hopes we get it right this time because we haven't come quite as far as he was thinking back then. Thank you very much.
That's great. Thanks very much, Nick. He was just a century ahead of his time, that's all. It's the next 50 years that we're going to see all of this. There are microphones. With the light shining in my eyes, I can't see where they are, but I am confident that they are there. There are also green question cards that you can fill out and hand either to one of the panelists or to one of the staff who will pick it up and bring it to the panelists. Let me start, if I can, by going back to a theme that a couple of you have touched on, and that is that this stuff isn't going to happen overnight. Dr. Walter's been doing this for a long time, and you have some results, but some of these new demonstrations, pilots, are going to take time to organize and get some return on investment flowing. Is there the political patience? I don't know if I should be asking you or the audience to allow the kinds of developments that you've been talking about to take root, start to change the culture, and actually deliver some results. Gail, you want to start?
I worry about that, and it's why I cautioned against what seemed to me wildly optimistic assumptions about how quickly we're going to see large amount of savings. I think that sets all of us up for a collective fall when they don't materialize. What I'm concerned about is how long we can go without making some significant changes in how we pay physicians. Many of you have heard me say almost ad nauseum that there's nothing more broken in Medicare than the relative value scale combined with the sustainable growth rate. But to remove the sustainable growth rate without replacing the relative value scale with something that doesn't pay physicians more for doing more and more complex is an invitation to even more unsustainable spending. That's my greatest concern. It is my greatest source of frustration that we've let 3, 4, 5 years go by and bemoan the fact and throw a little more money to try to keep fees flat without really doing something. This is probably the biggest immediate issue that I see on the horizon for Medicare. The other parts, hopefully, we can keep going while we try to come up with a better delivery system. But the physician payment problem is a major one. Word of caution is if you take away the pressure because of the sustainable growth rate, it will be very hard to get the physicians actively involved in embracing these very different changes. So push it down a year at a time until you can figure out how to replace the current RBRVS with sustainable growth rate.
Okay. All right. Yes, I would ask you to identify yourself and keep your questions as brief as you can so that we can get to as many as we can.
I'm Joe Luchak, communication consultant. And Ms. Walensky mentioned the difficulty of getting people into the program. Dr. Walter mentioned the 1990s, and that takes me back to the early 90s where the HMO started as an attempt to coordinate care as best it could be coordinated in those rudimentary computer days. And my question is, how much of what will be happening now will be based on what was learned from the HMO experience, and what happens if people hate it? Will they loosen it up again? Because the HMO actually controlled costs at that time, if you go back to the early 90s. And it seemed to me if we're going to control costs, we're probably going to have to do some of those types of things. So is that going to be a problem, or is it this so far divorced from HMOs that it won't make any difference?
Well, you're raising a very good point. The people don't always acknowledge how successful managed care in the aggregate was in the mid and late 1990s in terms of slowing down spending compared to what was going on in the fee-for-service sector. It's questionable that it was managing care much. It was mostly managing costs, making use of excess capacity. And it does raise the issue about what happens when you ignore the beneficiaries or the participants. My take on part of what we saw in the 1990s is that individuals in private insurance were not a part of the decision-making. Employers offered single plans or a limited choice, and employees found themselves in plans that constrained their choice. They didn't like it. You didn't see the kind of pushback you saw in Washington, where the Federal Employees Health Care Plan dominates so much of the insurance space, and people can change their insurance choices every November. To me, it's a good reminder that if the seniors are not a part of being able to choose the kind of plans that they can participate in, you ought to expect to see a lot of pushback. So a lot of what we may be learning from the 1990s is what not to do and to be smarter as we go ahead in this next round. There are a lot of good models out there. They just don't – they're not relevant for most of the population.
Anybody else? Stuart?
Just to add to that quickly, one of the things – one of the tools we have now that we didn't have in the 90s was much better ways of measuring quality of care. And I think that's a really crucial aspect to that situation. We can do better in making sure that care doesn't suffer. And whether or not it was true, there was certainly a strong perception in the 90s, certainly in the late 90s, that care was suffering under managed care. Well, now we can measure it better. And even though we have a long way to go to develop better measures of quality of care, we are a lot farther along than we were then.
I think you were next. Yes, okay. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm Barbara Tomar from the College of Emergency Physicians. But I have a question for Dr. Walter or anybody on the panel about the sustainability of ACOs. I mean, I was at the Hospital Association when PHOs were the up-and-coming thing, and that didn't turn out to be a raving success because, by and large, the hospitals have incentive to get their occupancy up, and all the incentives now will be geared toward keeping people out of the hospitals and out of the emergency departments as well. So how can you get hospitals leadership on board to do things that will basically sort of cut their revenue?
Well, my take is that many hospitals are going to struggle with this. But I did spend a few years on the American Hospital Association board, and there are very progressive leaders in the hospital community who I think believe that to do the right thing, we need to change how we look at what a hospital is, what it does, and how it works with physicians. And I think that the same is true in terms of the bell curve amongst physicians. There are many that are going to come into this game fighting and screaming, and others who believe that we should get going and make changes. And, of course, if we don't, we will see significant across-the-board cuts in unit pricing in upcoming years.
Yeah, go ahead, Stu.
I'd add to that 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 we're not talking – the most optimistic forecasts of what the impact of any of the initiatives would be. It doesn't involve a decline in healthcare spending. It involves a growth in healthcare spending, in fact, a growth of healthcare spending relative to the rest of the economy. So it's just a matter of shaving some off the top of the trajectory that's projected currently. So there ought to be a way to realign resources so that you can do the right thing and also not lose your shirt.
I'm with you. I think it's a real problem and that we need to make sure that physicians, at least we see models when the money goes to physicians and let them align as they choose with hospitals, and we can see whether or not they will do the right thing or be satisfied in shaving off the top.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello. My name is Farheen Qureshi. I'm a medical student, and I'm the legislative director for the American Medical Student Association. My question is in regards to primary care. On the individual patient level, primary care can always be is often the place, the point of coordination for healthcare. And primary care is also often considered a way to increase quality while decreasing costs, and as well as preventative medicine. How do you see the primary care shortage that we have currently being a kind of an obstacle to payment innovation, or do you see hopefully increased incentives in primary care as a way to help implement payment reforms in the future?
Good question. Go ahead, Mark.
I guess a couple of things. I mean, I think if these some of these innovations that are being talked about work in the way that they're described, they would change the view of the primary care physician. And in addition to reimbursement and lifestyle and other issues, one of the things that I've heard when I talk to people about why they do or do not accept or go into primary care is the notion of the importance of the role and what responsibility they have in providing care. And to the extent that a medical home or an ACO puts them much more at the center of the care process, that may change some of the view of people coming through medical school. Having said that, I also think there are things that, depending on how the reimbursement works, and the savings models work, there may be actually more resources for those types of physicians. But that said, I think there's probably changes that also need to occur on Medicare's, and this is stuff that the commission is talking about. I won't go into it right in detail, but there are changes that need to be made on the way Medicare's graduate medical education funding process works that I think could have a big impact on that. And I won't go into the details because it's off point here. And then the last thing I'll say, which I think Gail has referred to, and again, the commission has talked about this a lot, some of the rebalancing of the relative values within the fee schedule. So to be clear that even the individual service price signals are altered, I think, are ways to try and get at that. Those are at least some set of ideas.
Selective loan forgiveness would help a lot also, and I keep raising this, trying to get this idea embraced by either the Congress or the administration. It would at least take away a negative that exists now for many of the students and residents who carry big loan burdens.
Yes.
Hi. Tony Hausner, formerly with CMS. Just mentioned a few ideas or comments that I have. One, I think pay for performance that's being studied through physicians, hospitals, and home health agencies and others is going to be very critical in terms of moving us forward in improving and driving down costs. One project that was done a number of years ago by General Motors gave consumers financial incentives to pick better plans. I think that's an idea that should be expanded. And then I think a third factor that's critical is the more we get to outcome-based measures, I think that will help drive the system to be more efficient, more cost-efficient. So I'm interested in comments about those three items.
By the way, just as the panelists are considering their responses, one of the pieces you have on the sheet on the sheet that lists things not in your packets fully texted but rather on the website is an appendix to Sue Gutterman's paper that describes a lot of the initiatives, including some of the private sector initiatives that Tony was talking about. Anybody want to pick up on the question itself, Gail?
We've raised the issue, a number of us, about the importance of involving the individuals, the beneficiaries, depending on which population you're looking at. When you look at the healthcare reform legislation and much of what has happened historically in Medicare, all of the pressure is being put on or has been put on the provider community. And while it is important to change how we reimburse physicians and institutions so that we reward them for the kind of behavior we like to see, it makes little sense to me to ignore the incentives that are out there for the seniors as well. We can clearly reward them for choosing efficient providers, high-quality efficient providers. It's more common or becoming more common in the private sector. And while we haven't talked very much about this today, there is a real advantage to trying to have more coordination going on between the changes that are being tried in Medicare or Medicaid and what goes on in the private sector. So this may be an area where we'll see more innovation and leadership in terms of what's being tried to involve the patient consumer of healthcare or just the holder of the insurance, but it's a mistake to leave them out. They can't be ignored. When you try it, you get yourself in trouble. Again, to me, that's a big message of the 1990s and the managed care pushback is that people weren't brought into the process and the choice, and they didn't really like much what they saw.
One other aspect of Tony's question had to do with pay per performance, and I wanted to just follow up. We've been hearing about providers who are very upset with the variety of quality indicators or efficiency indicators that they have to comply with to get the pay for their performance, and that there are different competing ones that are described in Stu's appendix, as a matter of fact. And I wonder if folks had comments on that. Dr. Walter, do you have to jump through different hoops to get different rewards at the clinic?
Yeah, I think this is an important point, and I think when you look at what CMS is asking, what some of the private payers are asking for, the specialty societies have all developed measures, or many of them have developed measures. It is expensive, and it's hard to coordinate all those things at times. The other thing I would add, to just expand that, this whole issue of administrative simplification and the requirements we get not just on quality reporting, but around compliance with HIPAA and meaningful standards for electronic health record, I think I was told about 15% of our staff really are related to billing, collecting, and complying with regulation of one kind or another. There's a lot of money there. If we could find our way to some simplification of some measure, I think it would help us with bending this cost curve as well.
Mark?
I agree, and this is something that we've talked about as well on the commission. And I think here some of the discussion has been in terms of pilots and things like that, being sure that you have coordination between public and private efforts. And this is certainly an area where that could apply. With respect to pay for performance, if we're talking about narrow, kind of based on single, kind of siloed types of services, hospital, physician, small percentage rewards, I don't know that they affect a lot of change. They may send a very important environmental signal that the world is changing around you, but I don't know that they execute and kind of accomplish a major change. To the point on what kinds of measures, I think in some ways, while there are methodological issues associated with them, there seems to be, and I don't want to make this point too strongly, but seems to be some coalescing around things like readmission rates, avoidable admissions, use of the emergency room. Mortality generally has been around for a while, and it seems that you could get a handful of outcome measures that you could agree are at least a focus, if it's not the entire focus, that you could begin to drive some of these pilots and demonstrations off of.
Yeah.
There is one hesitation that I have to the issue being raised. I'm sympathetic to the burden that is being placed on clinicians and institutions with the multiple reporting requirements. I'm a little uneasy about coalescing too quickly around a narrow set of outcomes and performance measures, given how much we don't know and how quickly it is evolving. It would be possible to see the government put out, CMS put out, a relatively restricted set that everyone had to use, but I'm not sure the price that would be paid in doing so, because there is so much yet we are learning as we are going. So it's going to be a balance of how to try to minimize the burdens that we place on people and institutions providing services and making forward progress. Now, there is administrative simplification requirements in 2013 and 2014 as part of the Health Care Reform Act. We'll see how that actually plays out in terms of whether it produces the reduction in administrative burden that I assume the legislators hoped it would as they drafted it.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm just going to add that we are having some success migrating inputs into our electronic health records so that we are doing somewhat less chart abstraction on quality measures. And I think as these systems mature, and believe me, they're not mature yet, the electronic health record may help us with that burden to some degree.
Very good point. Yes. Okay. We've got a question here that comes from a congressional staffer asking the panel to address the issue of the new independent payment advisory board and whether you think it's going to play a big role in promoting payment reform and other innovation in Medicare. You want to start, Stu?
Of course, you know, the easy answer is that the effect that the board has depends on how well it actually carries out its mission. But I think it already plays an important role because one of the things that comes up when you're talking about alternative ways of paying and organizing and delivering care is the need to get away from fee-for-service and the need to make it clear that fee-for-service payment is not going to be a comfortable place to be down the line. And I think the existence of the Independent Payment Advisory Board kind of dramatizes that because if we don't come up with good ways of controlling the cost of health care, then we're going to be left with the more primitive tools that people have used in the past. And I think that it needs to be clear to everyone in the system that that's not going to be a pleasant alternative. So we need to do our best to make sure that we find alternatives that work and that are more palatable.
And just before you add your point of view, Gail, I just want to make sure that the primitive tools you're talking about are cuts in provider payment rates. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm not a supporter of the concept of the independent payment advisory board, and so I am hopeful that before it begins to take effect into the second half of the decade, that the Congress will have changed its mind and empowered the Secretary to put in place the results of pilots that have been shown to reduce spending and improve quality. And the reason that I'm not in favor of it is really twofold. The first is that once appointed, the individuals on the Independent Payment Advisory Board are totally unaccountable to the Congress or the American public or anyone else, unlike the Secretary and the CMS Administrator who remain accountable to the President, who remains accountable to the American public. Also that the exclusions and limitations of the Advisory Board are such that it focuses on only one narrow area, and these issues are much too broad to have that. But mainly I am hopeful that in its place we could see either authority granted or triggers put in place that would implement some of the pilots that are shown to reduce spending and improve quality without reliance on this otherwise unaccountable board.
And the second half of that question was addressed to Mark Miller. I just handed him the card so he wouldn't get blindsided. And that is, Mark, how will MedPAC, which advises Congress on payment policy, interact with the independent board, which presumably is going to have a relationship with Congress with respect to payment policy?
Well, this is the first I'm hearing of this, so. Also, I got to say, it is freezing cold up here. I don't know.
And let me just say, is there any, if there's someone in the back from our staff, if they can make any adjustments, it would be very helpful.
I slipped into a coma earlier, and I just.
I'm having trouble pressing the button right to turn the microphone on.
Yeah. A couple things before I bury myself further is, there were several things as we went down the table that I agree with, and I would just go, or I see too, let's put it that way. And just to kind of go back to the point, or the first point,
I think whether it's effective or not, there's a lot of questions. And, I mean, I think there's an appointment process, there's an organization process, a staff support process, and then to what Gail is saying, you know, it's playing field. So I think all of those are serious questions. And, you know, my honest answer is I don't know. With respect to what our role is, the legislation seemed pretty clear that they wanted MedPAC to continue doing what it's doing and gave us additional responsibilities to respond to the, as an additional product, to respond to the recommendations that the new entity makes and sort of say to the Congress, these are good ones. Here are alternatives, and that's my sense. And I am thinking about it. We have not made changes yet. There's still, it's unclear exactly when it will come online, but its actual role is still a few years off. But I am thinking about the how my organization will have to be configured to deal with it.
Okay. This question for Stuart. The person is concerned that the CMS implementation of the Innovation Center is not going to yield experimentation bold enough and persistent enough to satisfy Franklin Delano Roosevelt's standard that you cited. Their plans sound like just a bigger R&D shop. Maybe most important is fast experimentation, and I wonder if you could allay this person's concerns.
I'll try. What we've been hearing out of CMS is that there's every intention for them to think about these things differently than in the past. I agree that if they try to do just newly titled things in the same way that they've been done in the same environment that they've been done in, then we'll have a difficult time getting many successes out of the process. Although I would point out that the demonstrations process, which is frequently maligned, has produced a number of really substantial successes and improvements in both Medicare and throughout the healthcare system, including the prospective payment system for inpatient hospital payment, the hospice program, and, in fact, Medicare Advantage, what's now Medicare Advantage, as well as the PACE program and several other smaller scale but very important improvements. But still, it's interesting you refer to the R&D term, because I think that's exactly what CMS needs to do, is to think of this new innovation center as the R&D shop for Medicare and Medicaid. And just as private sector R&D shops try to function, they take some risks, they do new things, and they try to improve the standing of the entity that they work for, in this case the Medicare and Medicaid programs. And in terms of getting quick results, you know, I think there are some things that probably could produce relatively quick results. And I know, you know, I share the perspective that, you know, we certainly shouldn't expect to see a major bending of the curve in the next 6 months after the Innovation Center gets put in place. But, you know, 10 years passes before you know it. And there's a lot of money on the table for even small changes in that curve. If we, over the next 10 years, were able to hold health spending to, say, the rate of growth of GDP, then we'd be saving on the order of trillions of dollars over that period of time. That could certainly be used for other contingencies in the government or in the healthcare sector. So I think I'm optimistic. I think the charge is for this new center to work the way it needs to work to produce some real innovations. And I think the charge is for the healthcare sector to respond well and for us to think about how we can put incentives in place to make those responses constructive.
Dr. Walter?
Yeah, I just wanted to underscore something Gail said in her comments, which is I think we need to be realistic about how fast all this will happen. My organization was formed when our clinic merged with the hospital across the street in 1993. For the last 5 to 6 years, I think we have become much more focused on what I would call performance improvement, both in quality and cost. But it's 15 years, and we're still learning. And so I think that We want to get there, but it is going to be 10 or 15 or even 20 years, I think. The key thing is let's get it going, because as Stu said, 10 years will go by, and what a shame if we don't see some progress over the next 10 years.
Sort of a broad question, noting that CMS is only one, though one large, payer, and asking the panel to speak to how you see reorganization of structural components of physician practices occurring if only CMS supports that reorganization through its changes in payment methodology.
This is an issue that has come up in a number of other discussions about where Medicare can lead and where Medicare has to follow, or where the private sector can provide some leadership. Obviously, it varies somewhat with the speaker in terms of those views. But it seems to me that CMS can lead in terms of some of the pilots, can help organize some of these different ideas, fund them to see how they begin to play out. The private sector can, and I believe, will take advantage of some of the changes that are being tried out. In fact, has led some of the earlier rounds of the innovations already in terms of pay for performance and the bridges to excellence work, et cetera. Private sector is much more flexible in terms of how and when it can involve change. What CMS ultimately can do as the 800-pound gorilla is that when there is some sense of agreement about what works based on the pilots that are tried in the public sector and that are being used either before or in complementing these activities, can put it as the force of law of the land. But it will be very difficult to fundamentally change the organizational payment from where we are without having some supporting private sector involvement. A lot of this is going to be paying differently for providing care relative to what's been done in the past, and it will be difficult to differentiate payments for that care using quality bonuses and pay for performance if it's only being done in the private sector. That's been the hardest thing for the public sector to do. Every time it tries to do contracting, it tries to do competitive bidding, tries to differentiate in some way those that it wants to reward from others who may be providing or would like to provide the services, it has stumbled. And so it really will be trying to work with the private sector so that you can reinforce or try some other variations and be a resounding, a sounding board and a way to see whether you can't enlarge some of these interesting demonstrations in the private sector and then have them go forward in a change of law.
Let me just elaborate on that. What about, and we talked a little about this earlier, what about turning it on its head? That is, the kinds of private sector initiatives that now public programs, particularly Medicare, are having a deuce of a time joining, or maybe they don't want to join. And I've particularly heard from a number of state officials that they set up these demonstrations and can't get Medicare to cooperate, even when you're talking about, say, dual eligibles, where Medicare is such a major factor. How much is there in the new law, in the new authority, and how willing to go along those lines, and how willing are the folks who are doing it likely to be to use that authority? Stuart?
Well, there is language that encourages collaborative efforts with states, between Medicare and states. There's language in there that encourages collaborative effort with private payers. There is a platform for working with that. The legislation also creates an office for coordinating healthcare for the dual eligibles in CMS, and that's another as well as MedPAC and MACPAC, the organizations that the Center for Innovation ought to be working with. to make sure that it takes advantage of every opportunity to improve health care financing and delivery.
Please.
Just a couple things on this. I think this question is really important from the perspective that if Medicare is trying something and the private sector is not involved in any way, and depending on how it plays out, you know, the permanent risk there, or the risk that's always present, is access issues for the Medicare beneficiary if the providers decide not to play. So it's incredibly not to continue to play with Medicare. I think it's an incredibly important issue. I think Gail was saying, and I agree with it, that there will be some natural spillover. There pretty much has been whenever Medicare has done these innovations. The private sector has picked some of them up. So I think there's something there. But I think just to reinforce a point, and unfortunately I don't know how to do this, but reinforce a point of the need to draw in both Medicare and private and Medicaid providers into these demonstrations. And one place to think about that is there are places around the country where they're closer to that. Vermont has some models going, and there's some other places that have a little more of this. And it's not much, though. And certainly for CMS to at least try and focus there and see if they can draw off of those models as places to start where you might actually have beginning with both public and provider or public and private providers. One thing I'll say, and I just, you know, I'm hesitating to say this, but, well, it's out now. So there's a lot of reasons why I think that things don't come together well between the federal and the state governments, and I think there's lots of problems on both sides, you know, CMS's ability to kind of focus and bring resources to it and think across the programs is certainly part of it. But I also think it's incredibly naive to ignore the fact that there's also been something of a history here, where some states, when they get access to federal dollars and try and pool it in particular, they use it to step back their own efforts. And so I think it's also important that whenever the federal government steps into one of these situations where there's going to be this sharing of effort, and as analysts, we can all see the potential advantage here, trying to get, you know, post-acute care to work better so you avoid the hospitalization, which is on two different sides of the program. Everybody gets those models, but they do create opportunities. And what I guess wasn't mentioned, because it's so far back in history that most of you were not born yet, but I worked for a Medicaid agency, and for sure you're constantly focused on figuring out ways to get Medicare to pay for things that you're currently paying for. And so at least I'm not saying that these models shouldn't be examined, but there should be a decided program integrity and maintenance of effort component to it, because there have been some history here.
One of the real questions is, will Medicaid and Medicare finally start to work together? I think many of us have been frustrated at how siloed the dual eligibles are, the people who are represent a very small part of the population, but use an enormous share of the resources, who are on both Medicare and Medicaid. Again, this is an area where the legislation is permissive, even encourages such coordination, but that's a long way from actually seeing models of coordinated behavior take off.
Stu?
Well, actually, I'd go one step further. There's actually, there have been silos that are labeled Medicaid federal, and Medicaid state. And I think, you know, all three of those sets of players need to work constructively together. The good news is that I would think there's a strong incentive. These problems that we're facing are very serious, and the ability to address them adequately, which I think is immeasurably strengthened by working together rather than separately, and in each one's own self-interest, really has some terrific potential payoffs. And there's nothing to encourage people to talk to each other like the prospect of, you know, really benefiting, whether it be politically or financially, from doing things better together rather than doing things worse separately.
Pick up on that, because he's made a good point that I had written down and then forgot to say. I think particularly for the private payer private payers, something to stay focused on, and we had something of this conversation before, is that these models involve consolidation of providers, and that increases their power to leverage negotiations with the private sector, and that can drive up prices on the private sector side. So to Stu's point, that the notion that the actors may have some shared motivation for cooperating may be present, at least in that instance. If the private sector sees that Medicare is going to go ahead and do this, they may feel be somewhat compelled to look at these things so that they don't get the negative side of price increases.
Good point. Yes, go ahead, Stu.
Sorry, we seem to be bouncing back and forth. But one point on that, actually, that I've meant to raise because it's come up several times. The issue of consolidation has been raised a lot in the context of more coordinated care and integrated care systems. One thing I'd point out is that if you read the literature, a lot of consolidation seems to be happening right now. A lot of hospitals are buying up physician practices again. There seems to be a real move toward consolidation of market power. So one could argue that if you're going to have this consolidation anyway, you might as well use that consolidation or take advantage of it to help make the healthcare system better and put better incentives out there.
And watch out.
Can I ask the panel to kind of take one more step along that discussion, maybe a broader look? There's been a lot of talk about ways to make things more efficiently, but isn't it true that a lot of these changes really represent substantial gains for some providers and substantial losses for others? How big is that a problem, and is there sufficient stuff built into the new law and the demonstration and pilot authority to offset that to the extent that you can get some good results?
I think this is a very significant intermediate problem. I don't think it's a short-term problem because I don't think it'll be threatening in the short term as long as these are pilots and they're being tried various ways in various parts of the country. Ultimately, if we change how we finance and organize the delivery of health care, we will make an adjustment into the incentives included in the new form of a less fragmented payment for care. It's the intermediate part that I'm mostly concerned about. We have very disproportionate numbers of specialists versus primary care physicians. Much of what we've talked about will pull money relatively away from the high volume of procedures and payments that have gone in that direction and may potentially pull money away from some of the freestanding high-tech centers, ambulatory surgery centers, heart hospitals, orthopedic hospitals, et cetera, or at least put pressure on the numbers that are out there that are able to provide care on a going forward basis. And my presumption is that those that are going to be relatively disadvantaged by the shift in payments will not go into the night quietly. And that means we're going to have to expect to see pushback from the specialty groups or areas where there's likely to be excess capacity and a reorganized delivery system. Where it's going to be extremely important to be able to document what is happening to quality. The first charge when people aren't happy with a new system is my patients will get poor quality or less access or will have other issues that make them unhappy. And it will be very important to be able to show in a credible way whether or not this is the case. But to understand if we're trying to shift the incentives so that we encourage integrated care and more focus on primary and preventive care and less in the way of what appears to be very high volume, technically sophisticated care that may not have the kind of clinical value that had been presumed, that there will be lots of pushback, particularly in this intermediate period. if we can't demonstrate that quality is as good or better, it is going to be hard to sustain that kind of movement.
Yes, yes, go ahead, Mark.
I mean, I think two thoughts, and I think Gail's assessment is right. I mean, I think this will be a problem, and I think it's a problem that will be present, and we should just assume that we're going to have to live with it and face it. And I think probably the two ways to think about it is one is collaboration, where, you know, as these new models are developed and the measurement for performance is developed, you have input from the provider community so that at least you have the shred of coming back at the end and saying, well, you were involved in crafting this, and if your performance or the outcome is not what you like, you at least had some input. Now, we all know that that doesn't necessarily get you very far down the road, but it's still, you know, something that, that should be done, both for sound clinical and design reasons, and two, for potentially being able to say, well, you were involved in this. I think the other thing, and I think a number of people have touched on this, I most remember Nick saying it, but just to make sure if anyone else did, is the other way that, that this works is that if the fee-for-service side of things, the kind of standard traditional fee-for-service side, becomes a more difficult place to live due to payment rate limitations and that type of thing, you're creating an environment where the provider is looking at their circumstance and saying, well, perhaps these new models are at least better than where I currently am. And again, that involves not necessarily the pilots and demonstrations as much as the larger context and what's happening with Congress and the Medicare program broadly.
Okay. We have time for just one more question, and we fortuitously have one more questioner. Let me ask you to use the time to fill that blue evaluation form out, if you would, to help us sort out new subjects and identify new speakers and improve these programs. And if I can, I'm going to invoke my NPR persona and say we have time for a 30-second question.
Bob Griss with the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health. Most of the conversation has been about how inefficient our fee-for-service system is and what innovations can be used for shifting it into more integrated care. But I haven't heard a lot of talk about how to deal with the distribution problems of our healthcare resources, which create its own inefficiencies. The 50% of the counties in the country which are medically underserved areas, for example. Are we going to be using any leverage from the public sector to deal with shifting resources so that more people have a chance to have equal access to care? So far, the conversation really has focused...
Bob, can we get get an answer? And we've got somebody from Montana, which has a number of underserved areas, I would imagine. Do you want to try to take a crack at that first, Nick?
Well, I'm certainly no expert on how people are thinking about resources to be put in play to solve what I think is a real problem. In Montana, however, we work very closely with our public health department and the community health centers. We are using telemedicine at rapidly growing rates to reach out several hundred miles to provide specialty care follow-up and even mental health. So I think there are some interesting things that will come into play as we address this problem. How policy will help us shape it in terms of resources, I don't have an answer for you.
Well, there is $11 billion, I think, that was allotted to the community health center, rural health center advancement, and so that it will be a significant way to try, not just in some of the hardcore urban areas, but in some of the rural areas, to improve the availability of providers of various sorts. There has been long-term added bonuses from time to time for physicians who practice in underserved areas defined in various ways, and that also is present in the legislation. But I think Nick has hit a good point. It is likely to be a combination of learning how to use our resources in smarter ways, telemedicine, other ways to provide access to people who are living in areas where there are shortages of various types of medical supplies. And
one last point. There is a body of research, some of it that we've sponsored, that indicates that better coordination of care does produce better outcomes for underserved population. And on top of that, if we figure out how to coordinate our health system, we'll be able to better leverage the resources we do have available to address the greater needs of our population, all segments of our population.
That's a pretty profound and good way to end this discussion, which I personally have found quite useful and enlightening. Let me thank you for being a big part of the reason that's the case. Thank you for filling out that blue evaluation form, which I know you all either have done or are about to do. Thanks to our friends at the Commonwealth Fund, Karen and Davis and Stu and Rachel Newsom and the rest of the folks. And particularly, I'd like to thank the staff of the Alliance, who's just been through a series of 5 briefings in 4.5 weeks, along with some other things that are going on, and things have gone much more smoothly than I had any right to expect. And thank you for your effort, and thank you for your continuing service. We'll be picking up more of the themes of implementation in subsequent briefings. Urge you to suggest topics that we can focus on that will be of use to you in your work, and ask you to join me in thanking the panel for an extremely useful and tough discussion of a very difficult subject.